narrower blue stole. He had seen them once and only once, a long way from Tarvalin, but he could not forget the two most powerful women among the Aes Sedai. The Ammerlin's eyebrows rose at the sight of him standing there, with the blanket hanging from his shoulders and his purse and dice cups in his hands.
"I don't think you will need those for a while yet, my son," she said dryly. "Put them up and get back to bed before you fall on your face."
He hesitated, his back stiffening, but his knees chose that moment to wobble, and the two Aes Sedai were looking at him, dark eyes and blue alike, appearing to read his every rebellious thought. He did as he was told, holding the blanket around him with both hands. He lay down straight as a board, not sure what else he could do.
"How are you feeling?" the Ammerlin asked briskly as she put a hand on his head.
Goosebumps covered his skin. Had she done something with the One Power, or was it being touched by an Aes Sedai that made him feel a chill?
"I'm fine," he told her. "Why, I'm ready to be on my way. Just let me say goodbye to Egwene and Nynaeve, and I'll be out of your hair. I mean, I will go, Mother."
Moraine and Varen had not seemed to care much how he talked, but this was the Ammerlin seat, after all.
"Nonsense," the Ammerlin said.
She pulled the high-backed chair around, closer to the bed, and sat, addressing Lyanna.
"Men always seem to refuse to admit they are sick until they're sick enough to make twice as much work for women. Then they claim they're well too soon, with the same result."
The keeper glanced at Matt and nodded.
"Yes, Mother. Yet this one cannot claim he is well when he can barely stand up. At least he has eaten everything on his tray. I'd be surprised if he had left enough crumbs to interest a finch. And still hungry, unless I miss my guess.
I could have someone bring him a pie, Mother, or some cakes."
"No, I think he has had as much as he can hold for now. If he brings it all back up, it won't do him any good."
Matt scowled. It seemed to him that when you got sick, you became invisible to women unless they were actually talking to you. And then they took at least 10 years off your age. Nynaeve, his mother, his sisters, the Ammerlin seat, they all did it.
"I'm not hungry at all," he announced. "I'm fine. If you will let me put my clothes on, I'll show you how well I am. I will be out of here before you know it."
They were both looking at him now. He cleared his throat.
Mother.
The Ammerlin snorted.
"You've eaten a meal for 5, and you will eat 3 or 4 like it every day, for days yet. Or else you will starve to death. You've just been healed from a link to the evil that killed every man, woman, and child in Aredhol, and no less strong for near 2,000 years waiting for you to pick it up. It was killing you just as surely as it killed them. That is not like having a fish spine stuck in your thumb, boy. We very nearly killed you ourselves trying to save you."
"I am not hungry," he maintained.
His stomach growled loudly to give him the lie.
"I read you aright the first time I saw you," the Ammerlin said. "I knew right then you'd bolt like a startled fisher bird if you ever thought someone was trying to hold you. As well I took precautions."
He eyed them warily.
"Precautions?"
They looked back, all serenity. He felt as if their eyes were pinning him to the bed.
"Your name and description are on their way to the bridge guards," the Ammerlin said, "and the dark masters. I'll not try to hold you inside the tower, but you will not leave Tarvalin unless you are well. Should you try to hide in the city, hunger will drive you back here eventually, or if it doesn't, we will find you before you starve."
"Why do you want to keep me here so badly?" he demanded.
He heard Selene's voice.
"They want to use you."
"Why should you care whether I starve or not? I can feed myself."
The Ammerlin gave a small laugh with little amusement in it.
"With 2 silver marks and a handful of copper, my son, your dice would need to be very lucky indeed to buy all the food you'll need in the next few days. We do not heal people, then let them waste our efforts by dying while they still need care. In addition to which, you may yet need more healing."
"More? You said you had healed me. Why should I need more?"
"My son," you carried that dagger for months. I believe we dug every trace of it out of you, but if we missed even the smallest speck, it could still be fatal. And who knows what effect your having it in your possession so long may have. Half a year from now, a year, and you may wish you had an Aes Sedai to hand to heal you again.
You want me to stay here a year? He said incredulously and loudly.
Lyanna shifted her feet and eyed him sharply, but the Amalyn's calm features were unruffled. Perhaps not so long as that, my son. Long enough to be certain, though. Surely you want as much. Would you set sail in a boat when you didn't know whether the caulking would hold or whether a plank might be rotten?
I never had much to do with boats, Matt muttered.
It might be true. Aes Sedai never lied, but there were too many mites and mays in it for him. I've been gone from home a long time, Mother. My Da, my mother, probably think I am dead.
If you wish to write a letter to them, I will see that it is carried to Emmons Field.
Matt waited for more, but no more came.
Thank you, Mother.
He essayed a small laugh.
I'm half surprised my Da did not come looking for me. He's the kind of man who would.
He was not sure, but he thought there was a small hesitation before the Amalyn answered.
He did come.
Lyanna spoke to him. The keeper took it up immediately.
We did not know where you were then, Matt. I told him so, and he left before the heavy snows. I gave him some gold to make the journey home easier.
No doubt, the Amalyn said, he will be pleased to hear from you, and your mother will, certainly. Give me the letter when you have written it, and I will see to it. They had told him, but he had had to ask. And they didn't mention Rand's Da. Maybe because they didn't think I would care, and maybe because... Burn me, I don't know. Who can tell with Aes Sedai?
I was traveling with a friend, Mother. Randall Thor, you remember him. Do you know if he is all right? I bet his Da is worried, too.
As far as I know, the Amalyn said smoothly, the boy is well enough, but who can say? I have seen him only once, the time I saw you in Faldara.
She turned to the keeper.
Perhaps he could do with a small piece of pie, Lyanna, and something for his throat if he is going to do all this talking. Will you see that it is brought to him?
The tall Aes Sedai left with a murmured,
As you command, Mother.
When the Amalyn turned back to Matt, she was smiling, but her eyes were blue ice.
There are things it would be dangerous for you to talk about, perhaps even in front of Lyanna. A flapping tongue has killed more men than sudden storms ever did.
Dangerous, Mother?
His mouth felt suddenly parched, but he resisted the urge to lick his lips.
Light! How much does she know about Rand? If only Moraine didn't keep so many secrets!
Mother, I don't know anything dangerous. I can hardly remember half of what I do know.
Do you remember the horn?
What horn is that, Mother?
She was on her feet and looming over him so fast he hardly saw her move.
You play games with me, boy, and I will make you weep for your mother to come running. I have no time for games, and neither do you. Now do you remember?
Clutching the blanket tightly around him, he had to swallow before he could say,
I remember, Mother.
She seemed to relax just a little, and Matt shrugged his shoulders queasily. He felt as if he had just been allowed to lift them off a chopping block.
Good. That is good, Matt.
She sat back down slowly, studying him.
Do you know that you are linked to the horn?
He mouthed the word linked silently, shocked, and she nodded.
I did not think you knew. You were the first to blow the horn of Valir after it was found. For you, it will summon dead heroes back from the grave. For anyone else, it is only a horn, so long as you live.
He took a deep breath.
So long as I live,
he said in a dull voice, and the Amalyn nodded.
You could have let me die.
She nodded again.
Then you could have had anyone you want blow it, and it would have worked for them. Another nod.
Blood and ashes! You mean me to blow it for you? When the last battle comes, you mean me to call heroes back from the grave to fight the Dark One for you? Blood and bloody ashes!
She put an elbow on the arm of the chair and propped her chin on her hand. Her eyes never left him.
Would you prefer the alternative?
He frowned, then remembered what the alternative was. If someone else had to sound the horn.
You want me to blow the horn?
Then I'll blow the horn. I never said I would not, did I? The Ammerlin gave an exasperated sigh.
You remind me of my Uncle Juan. No one could ever pin him down. He liked to gamble, too, and he'd much rather have fun than work. He died pulling children out of a burning house. He wouldn't stop going back as long as there was one left inside.
Are you like him, Matt? Will you be there when the flames are high? He could not meet her eyes. He studied his fingers as they plucked irritably at his blanket.
I'm no hero. I do what I have to do, but I am no hero.
Most of those we call heroes only did what they had to do. I suppose it will have to be enough, for now. You must not speak to anyone but me of the horn, my son, or of your link to it.
For now, he thought. It's all you are bloody going to get, now or ever. I don't mean to bloody tell every...
She arched an eyebrow, and he made his voice smooth again.
I do not want to tell anyone. I wish nobody knew. Why do you want to keep it such a secret? Don't you trust your Aes Sedai?
For a long moment, he thought he had gone too far. Her face hardened, and her look could have carved axe handles.
If I could make it so that only you and I knew, she said coldly, I would. The more people know a thing, the more the knowledge spreads, even with the best will. Most of the world believes the Horn of Elir is only legend, and those who know better believe one of the hunters has yet to find it. But Shale Ghul knows it has been found, and that means at least some Dark Friends know. But they do not know where it is, and if the light shines in us, they do not know you sounded it. Do you really want Dark Friends coming after you? Half-men or other shadow spawn? They want the horn. You must know that. It will work as well for the shadow as for the light. But if it is to work for them, they must take you or kill you. Do you want to risk that?
Matt wished he had another blanket and maybe a goose down comforter. The room suddenly felt very cold.
Are you telling me Dark Friends could come after me here? I thought the White Tower could keep Dark Friends out.
He remembered what Celine had said about the Black Adja and wondered what the Ammerlin would say to that.
A good reason to stay, wouldn't you say?
She got to her feet, smoothing her skirts.
Rest, my son. Soon you will feel much better. Rest.
She closed the door softly behind her. For a long time, Matt lay staring up at the ceiling. He barely noticed when a serving woman came with his piece of pie and another pitcher of milk, taking the tray of empty dishes when she went. His stomach rumbled loudly at the warm smell of apples and spices, but he paid that no mind either. The Ammerlin thought she held him like a sheep in a pen. And Celine?
Who in the light is she? What does she want?
Celine had been right about some things, but the Ammerlin had told him she meant to use him and how. In a way. There were too many holes in what she had said to suit him, too many holes she could slip something deadly through. The Ammerlin wanted something, and Celine wanted something, and he was the rope they were tugging between them. He thought he would rather face Trollocs than be caught between those two. There had to be a way out of Tar Valon, a way out of both their grasps. Once he was beyond the river, he could keep out of Aes Sedai hands and Celine's and Dark Friends, too. He was sure of it. There had to be a way. All he had to do was think about it from every angle. The pie grew cold on the table.
Chapter 21. A World of Dreams. Egwene scrubbed her hands with a hand towel as she hurried down the dimly lit corridor. She had washed them twice, but they still felt greasy. She had not thought there could be so many pots in the world, and today had been bake day, so buckets of ashes had had to be hauled from the ovens, and the hearths cleaned, and the tables rubbed bone white with fine sand, and the floors scrubbed on hands and knees. Ash and grease stained her white dress. Her back ached, and she wanted to be in her bed, but Verin had come to the kitchens, supposedly for a meal to eat in her rooms, and whispered a summons to her in passing. Verin had her quarters above the library, in corridors used only by a few other brown sisters. There was a dusty air to the halls there, as if the women who lived along them were too busy with other things to bother having the servants clean very often, and the passages took odd turns and twists, sometimes dipping or rising unexpectedly. The tapestries were few, their colorful weavings dulled, apparently cleaned as seldom as everything else here. Many of the lamps were unlit, plunging much of the hall into gloom. Egwene thought she had it to herself, except for a flash of white ahead, perhaps a novice or a servant scurrying about some task. Her shoes, clicking on bare black and white floor tiles, made echoes. It was not a comfortable place for one thinking of the Black Aja. She found what Verin had told her to look for, a dark paneled door at the top of a rise, beside a dusty tapestry of a king on horseback receiving the surrender of another king. Verin had named the pair of them, men dead hundreds of years before Arthur Hawkwing was born. Verin always seemed to know such things, but Egwene could not remember their names or the long-vanished countries they had ruled. It was the only wall hanging she had seen that matched Verin's description, though. Minus the sound of her own footsteps, the hallway seemed even emptier than before, and more threatening. She rapped on the door and entered hurriedly on the heels of an absent-minded, "Who is it? Come in." One step into the room, she stopped and stared. Shelves lined the walls, except for one door that must lead to inner rooms and except for where maps hung, often in layers, and what seemed to be charts of the night sky. She recognized the names of some constellations, the Plowman and the Haywain, the Archer and the Five Sisters, but others were unfamiliar. Books and papers and scrolls covered nearly every flat surface, with all sorts of odd things interspersed among the piles, and sometimes on top of them. Strange shapes of glass or metal, spheres and tubes interlinked, and circles held inside circles, stood among bones and skulls of every shape and description. What appeared to be a stuffed brown owl, not much bigger than Egwene's hand, stood on what seemed to be a bleached white lizard's skull, but could not be, for the skull was longer than her arm and had crooked teeth as big as her fingers. Candlesticks had been stuck about in a haphazard fashion, giving good light here and shadows there, although seeming in danger of setting fire to papers in some places. The owl blinked at her, and she jumped. "Ah, yes," Verin said. She was seated behind a table as cluttered as everything else in the room, a torn page held carefully in her hands. "It is you, yes." She noticed Egwene's sideways glance at the owl and said absently, "He keeps down mice. They chew paper." Her gesture took in the entire room and reminded her of the page she held. "Fascinating, this. Roselle of Essam claimed more than 100 pages survived the breaking, and she should have known, since she wrote barely 200 years afterwards, but only this one piece still exists, so far as I know. Perhaps only this very copy. Roselle wrote that it held secrets the world could not face, and she would not speak of them plainly. I have read this page 1,000 times, trying to decipher what she meant." The tiny owl blinked at Egwene again. She tried not to look at it. "What does it say, Verin?" said I. Verin blinked, very much as the owl had. "What does it say? It is a direct translation, mind, and reads almost like a bard reciting in high chant. Listen. Heart of the dark, Baalzamon. Name hidden within name, shrouded by name. Secret buried within secret, cloaked by secret. Betrayer of hope. Ishmael betrays all hope. Truth burns and sears. Hope fails before truth. A lie is our shield. Who can stand against the heart of the dark? Who can face the betrayer of hope? Soul of shadow, soul of the shadow, he is... She stopped with a sigh. It ends there. What do you make of it? I don't know, Egwene said. I do not like it. Well, why should you, child? Like it or understand it? I have studied it nearly 40 years, and I do neither. Verin carefully placed the page inside a silk-lined folder of stiff leather, then casually stuffed the folder into a stack of papers. But you did not come for that. She rummaged across the table, muttering to herself, several times barely catching a pile of books or manuscripts before it toppled. Finally, she came up with a handful of pages covered in a thin, spidery hand and tied with nubby string. Here, child, everything that is known about Leandrin and the women who went with her, names, ages, ajahs, where they were born, everything I could find in the records, even how they performed in their studies. What we know of the Turangrial they took, too, which isn't much. Only descriptions, for the most part. I do not know whether any of this will help. I saw nothing of any use in this. Perhaps one of us will see something. A sudden wave of suspicion took Egwene by surprise. If she didn't leave something out. The Amarlin seemed to trust Verin only because she had to. What if Verin was Black Aja herself? She gave herself a shake. She had traveled all the way from Toman Head to Tar Valon with Verin, and she refused to believe this plump scholar could be a dark friend. I trust you, Verin Sedai. Can I really? The Aes Sedai blinked at her again, then dismissed whatever thought had come to her with a shake of her head. That list I gave you may be important, or it may be so much waste of paper, but it isn't the only reason I summoned you. She started moving things on the table, making some shaky stacks taller to clear a space. I understand from Anaya that you might become a dreamer. The last was Corianin Nadil 473 years ago, and from what I can make of the records, she barely deserved the name. It would be quite interesting if you do. She tested me, Verin Sedai, but she couldn't be sure that any of my dreams foretold the future. That is only part of what a dreamer does, child. Perhaps the least part. Anaya believes in bringing girls along too slowly, in my opinion. Look here. With one finger, Verin drew a number of parallel lines across the area she had cleared, lines clear in dust atop the old beeswax. Let these represent worlds that might exist if different choices had been made, if major turning points in the pattern had gone another way. The worlds reached by the portal stones, Egwene said, to show she had listened to Verin's lectures on the journey from Toman Head. What could this possibly have to do with whether or not she was a dreamer? Very good. But the pattern may be even more complex than that, child. The wheel weaves our lives to make the pattern of an age, but the ages themselves are woven into the age lace, the great pattern. Who can know if this is even the 10th part of the weaving, though? Some in the Age of Legends apparently believe that there were still other worlds, even harder to reach than the worlds of the portal stones, if that can be believed, lying like this. She drew more lines, cross-hatching the first set. For a moment she stared at them. The warp and the woof of the weave. Perhaps the Wheel of Time weaves a still greater pattern from worlds. Straightening, she dusted her hands. Well, that is neither here nor there. In all of these worlds, whatever their other variations, a few things are constant. One is that the Dark One is imprisoned in all of them. In spite of herself, Egwene stepped closer to peer at the lines Verin had drawn. In all of them? How can that be? Are you saying there is a father of lies for each world? The thought of so many Dark Ones made her shiver. No, child. There is one creator who exists everywhere at once for all of these worlds. In the same way, there is only one Dark One who also exists in all of these worlds at once. If he is freed from the prison the creator made in one world, he is freed on all. So long as he is kept prisoner in one, he remains imprisoned on all. That does not seem to make sense, Egwene protested. Paradox, child. The Dark One is the embodiment of paradox and chaos, the destroyer of reason and logic, the breaker of balance, the unmaker of order. The owl suddenly took flight on silent wings, landing atop a large white skull on a shelf behind the Aes Sedai. It peered down at the two women, blinking. Egwene had noticed the skull when she came in, with its curled horns and snout, and vaguely wondered what sort of ram had so big a head. Now she took in the roundness of it, the high forehead. Not a ram's skull, a Trolloc. She drew a shuddering breath. "Verin Sedai, what does this have to do with being a dreamer? The Dark One is bound in Sheol Ghul, and I do not want to even think of him escaping. But the seals on his prison are weakening. Even novices know that now." "Do with being a dreamer? Why, nothing, child, except that we must all confront the Dark One in one way or another. He is prisoned now, but the pattern did not bring Randall Thor into the world for no purpose. The dragon reborn will face the Lord of the Grave, that much is sure, if Rand survives that long, of course. The Dark One will try to distort the pattern if he can. Well, we have gone rather far afield, haven't we? Forgive me, Verin Sedai, but if this," Egwene indicated the lines drawn in the dust, "has nothing to do with being a dreamer, why are you telling me about it?" Verin stared at her as if she were deliberately being dense. "Nothing? Of course it has something to do with it, child. The point is that there is a third constant besides the Creator and the Dark One. There is a world that lies within each of these others, inside all of them at the same time, or perhaps surrounding them. Writers in the Age of Legends called it Telaran Riod, the unseen world. Perhaps the world of dreams is a better translation. Many people, ordinary folk who could not think of channeling, sometimes glimpse Telaran Riod in their dreams, and even catch glimmers of these other worlds through it. Think of some of the peculiar things you have seen in your dreams. But a dreamer, child, a true dreamer, can enter Telaran Riod." Egwene tried to swallow, but a lump in her throat stopped her. "Enter it? I don't think I am a dreamer, Verin Sedai. Anaya Sedai's tests," Verin cut her off, "prove nothing one way or the other. And Anaya still believes that you may very well be one." "I suppose I will learn whether I am or not eventually," Egwene mumbled. "Light, I want to be, don't I? I want to learn. I want it all." "You have no time to wait, child. The Amarlin has entrusted a great task to you and Nynaeve. You must reach out for any tool you might be able to use." Verin dug a red wooden box from under the welter on her table. The box was large enough to hold sheets of paper, but when the Aes Sedai opened the lid a crack, all she pulled out was a ring carved from stone, all flecks and stripes of blue and brown and red, and too large to be a finger ring. "Here, child." Egwene shifted the papers to take it, and her eyes widened in surprise. The ring certainly looked like stone, but it felt harder than steel and heavier than lead, and the circle of it was twisted. If she ran a finger along one edge, it would go around twice, inside as well as out. It only had one edge. She moved her finger along that edge twice, just to convince herself. "Corianna Nadil," Verin said, "had that Turangrial in her possession for most of her life. You will keep it now." Egwene almost dropped the ring. "A Turangrial? I am to keep a Turangrial?" Verin seemed not to notice her shock. "According to her, it eases the passage to Telaran Riod. She claimed it would work for those without talent as well as for Aes Sedai, so long as you are touching it when you sleep. There are dangers, of course. Telaran Riod is not like other dreams. What happens there is real. You are actually there, instead of just glimpsing it." She pushed back the sleeve of her dress, revealing a faded scar the length of her forearm. "I tried it myself once, some years ago. Anaya's healing did not work as well as it should have. Remember that." The Aes Sedai let her sleeve cover the scar again. "I will be careful, Verin Sedai." "Real? My dreams are bad enough as they are. I want no dreams that leave scars. I'll put it in a sack and stick it in a dark corner and leave it there. But she wanted to learn. She wanted to be Aes Sedai, and no Aes Sedai had been a dreamer in nearly 500 years. I'll be very careful. She slipped the ring into her pouch and tugged the drawstrings tight, then picked up the papers Varen had given her. Remember to keep it hidden, child. No novice or even an accepted should have a thing like that in her possession, but it may prove useful to you. Keep it hidden. Yes, Varen, said I. Remembering Varen's scar, she almost wished another Aes Sedai would come along and take it from her right then. Good child. Now off with you. It grows late, and you must be up early to help with breakfast. Sleep well. Varen sat looking at the door for a long time after it closed behind Egwene. The owl hooted softly behind her. Pulling the red box to her, she opened the lid all the way and frowned at what nearly filled the space. Page upon page, covered with a precise hand, the black ink barely faded after nearly 500 years. Corianna Nadil's notes, everything she had learned in 50 years of studying that peculiar Terangrial. A secretive woman, Corianan. She had kept by far the greater part of her knowledge from everyone, trusting it only to these pages. Only chance and a habit of rummaging through old papers in the library had led Varen to them. As far as she could discover, no Aes Sedai besides herself knew of the Terangrial. Corianan had managed to erase its existence from the records. Once again she considered burning the manuscript, just as she had considered giving it to Egwene. But destroying knowledge, any knowledge, was anathema to her. As for the other, no. It is best by far to leave things as they are. What will happen will happen. She let the lid drop shut. Now where did I put that page? Frowning, she began to search the stacks of books and papers for the leather folder. Egwene was already out of her mind. Chapter 22. The Price of the Ring. Egwene had only gone a short distance from Varen's rooms when Shiriam met her. The mistress of novices wore a preoccupied frown. If someone hadn't remembered Varen speaking to you, I might not have found you. The Aes Sedai sounded mildly irritated. Come along, child. You are holding everything up. What are those papers? Egwene clutched them a little tighter. She tried to make her voice both meek and respectful. Varen Sedai thinks I should study them, Aes Sedai. What would she do if Shiriam asked to see them? What excuse could she give for refusing? What explanation for pages telling all about 13 women of the Black Aja and the Terangrial they had stolen? But Shiriam seemed to have dismissed the papers from her mind as soon as she asked. Never mind that. You are wanted, and everyone is waiting. She took Egwene's arm and forced her to walk faster. Wanted, Shiriam Sedai. Waiting for what? Shiriam shook her head with exasperation. Did you forget that you are to be raised to the accepted? When you come to my study tomorrow, you'll be wearing the ring, though I doubt it will soothe you very much. Egwene tried to stop short, but the Aes Sedai hurried her on, taking a narrow set of stairs that curled down through the library walls. Tonight? Already? But I'm half asleep, Aes Sedai, and dirty, and I thought I would have days yet to get ready, to prepare. The hour waits on no woman, Shiriam said. The wheel weaves as the wheel wills, when the wheel wills. Besides, how would you prepare? You already know the things you must, more than your friend Nynaeve did. She pushed Egwene through a tiny door at the foot of the stairs and hurried her across another hall to a ramp curving down and down. I listened to the lectures, Egwene protested. And I remember them, but can't I have a night's sleep first? The winding ramp seemed to have no end. The Amarlin's seat decided there was no point in waiting. Shiriam gave Egwene a sidelong smile. Her exact words were, once you decide to gut a fish, there's no use waiting till it rots. Elaine has already been through the arches by this time, and the Amarlin means you to go through tonight as well. Not that I can see the point of such a hurry, she added, half to herself. But when the Amarlin commands, we obey. Egwene let herself be pulled down the ramp in silence, a knot forming in her belly. Nynaeve had been far from forthcoming about what had happened when she was raised to the accepted. She would not speak of it at all except for a grimaced, "I hate Aes Sedai." Egwene was trembling by the time the ramp finally ended at a broad hallway far below the tower in the rock of the island. The hall was plain and undecorated, the pale rock through which it had been hewn smoothed but left otherwise untouched, and there was only one set of dark wooden doors, as tall and wide as fortress gates and as plain, although of smoothly finished and finely fitted planks at the very end. Those great doors were so well balanced, though, that Shiryam easily pushed one open and pulled Egwene through after her into a great domed chamber. "Not before time," Elida snapped. She stood to one side in her red-fringed shawl beside a table on which sat three large silver chalices. Lamps on tall stands illumined the chamber and what sat centered under the dome. Three rounded silver arches, just tall enough to walk under, sitting on a thick silver ring with their ends touching where they joined it. An Aes Sedai sat cross-legged on the bare rock before each of the spots where arches joined ring, all three wearing their shawls. Alana was the sister of the green Aja, but she did not know the yellow sister or the white. Surrounded by the glow of Saidar embraced, the three Aes Sedai stared fixedly at the arches, and within the silver structure an answering glow flickered and grew. That structure was a Turangrial, and whatever it had been made for in the Age of Legends, now novices passed through it to become accepted. Inside it, Egwene would have to face her fears three times. The white light within the arches no longer flickered. It stayed within them as if confined, but it filled the space, made it opaque. "Be easy, Elida," Shiryam said calmly. "We will be done soon." She turned to Egwene. "Novices are given three chances at this. You may refuse twice to enter, but at the third refusal you are sent away from the tower forever. That is how it is done usually, and you certainly have the right to refuse, but I do not think the Ammerlin seat will be pleased with you if you do." "She should not be given this chance." There was iron in Elida's voice, and her face was scarcely softer. "I do not care what her potential is. She should be put out of the tower, or failing that, set to scrubbing floors for the next 10 years. Shiryam gave the red sister a sharp look. "You were not so adamant about Elaine. You demanded to be part of this, Elida, perhaps because of Elaine, and you will do your part for this girl as well as you are supposed to, or you will leave and I will find another." The two Aes Sedai stared at one another until Egwene would not have been surprised to see the glow of the One Power surround them. Finally, Elida gave a toss to her head and sniffed loudly. "If it must be done, let us do it. Give the miserable girl her chance to refuse and be done with it. It is late." "I won't refuse." Egwene's voice quavered, but she steadied it and held her head high. "I want to go on." "Good," Shiryam said. "Good. Now I will tell you two things no woman hears until she stands where you do. Once you begin, you must go on to the end. Refuse at any point, and you will be put out of the tower just as if you had refused to begin for the third time. Second, to seek, to strive, is to know danger." She sounded as if she had said this many times. There was a light of sympathy in her eyes, but her face was almost as stern as Elida's. The sympathy frightened Egwene more than the sternness. "Some women have entered and never come out. When the Turangrial was allowed to grow quiet, they were not there. And they were never seen again. If you will survive, you must be steadfast. Falter, fail, and..." Shiryam's face drove the unspoken words home. Egwene shivered. "This is your last chance. Refuse now, and it counts only as the first. You may still try twice more. If you accept now, there is no turning back. It is no shame to refuse. I could not do it my first time. Choose." "They never came out?" Egwene swallowed hard. "I want to be Aes Sedai, and first I have to become accepted. I accept. Shiryam nodded. Then ready yourself. Egwene blinked, then remembered. She had to enter unclothed. She bent to set down the tied bundle of papers Varen had given her, and hesitated. If she left them there, Shiryam or Elida, either one, could go through them while she was inside the Tarangrial. They could find that smaller Tarangrial in her pouch. If she refused to go on, she could hide them away, perhaps leave them with Nynaeve. Her breath caught. I cannot refuse now. I've already begun. Have you already chosen to refuse, child? Shiryam asked, frowning. Knowing what that will mean now? No, Aes Sedai, Egwene said quickly. Hastily, she undressed and folded her clothes, then set them on top of the pouch and the papers. It would have to do. Beside the Tarangrial, Alanna suddenly spoke. There is some sort of resonance. She never took her eyes from the arches. An echo, almost. I do not know from where. Is there a problem? Shiryam asked sharply. She sounded surprised, too. I will not send a woman in there if there is any problem. Egwene looked yearningly at her piled clothes. Please, yes, light a problem. Something that will let me hide those papers without refusing to enter. No, Alanna said. It is like having a bite-me buzz round your head when you're trying to think, but it does not interfere. I would not have mentioned it, only it has never happened before that I ever heard. She shook her head. It is gone now. Perhaps, Elida said dryly, others thought such a small thing was not worth mentioning. Let us go on. Shiryam's tone would not put up with any more distractions. Come. With a last glance at her clothes and the hidden papers, Egwene followed her toward the arches. The stone felt like ice under her bare feet. Whom do you bring with you, sister? Elida intoned. Continuing her measured pace, Shiryam replied. One who comes as a candidate for acceptance, sister. The three Aes Sedai around the Tarangrial did not move. Is she ready? She is ready to leave behind what she was, and passing through her fears, gain acceptance. Does she know her fears? She has never faced them, but now is willing. Then let her face what she fears. Even in its formality, there was a note of satisfaction in Elida's voice. The first time, Shiryam said, is for what was. The way back will come but once. Be steadfast. Egwene took a deep breath and stepped forward through the arch and into the glow. Light swallowed her whole. Giant Dautry dropped by. There's odd news down from Bearlawn with the peddler. Egwene raised her head from the cradle she was rocking. Rand was standing in the doorway. For an instant her head spun. She looked from Rand, my husband, to the child in the cradle, my daughter, and back again in wonder. The way back will come but once. Be steadfast. It was not her own thought, but a disembodied voice that could have been inside her head or out, male or female, yet emotionless and unknowable. Somehow it did not seem strange to her. The moment of wonder passed, and the only thing to wonder about was why she had thought anything seemed out of round. Of course Rand was her husband, her handsome, loving husband, and Joya was her daughter, the most beautiful, sweetest little girl in the Two Rivers. Tam, Rand's father, was out with the sheep, supposedly so Rand could work on the barn, but really so he could have more time to play with Joya. This afternoon Egwene's mother and father would come out from the village, and probably Nynaeve, to see if motherhood was interfering with Egwene's studies to replace Nynaeve as wisdom one day. What kind of news? She asked. She took up rocking the cradle again, and Rand came over to grin down at the tiny child wrapped in swaddling clothes. Egwene laughed softly to herself. He was so taken with his daughter that he did not hear what people said to him half the time. Rand? What kind of news? Rand? What? His grin faded. Strange news. War. There's some big war taking up most of the world, so Jyne claims. That was strange news, Word of wars seldom reached the two rivers till the wars were long done. He says everybody is fighting some folk called the Shawkin or the Sanchan or something like that. I never heard of them. Egwene knew. She thought she knew. Whatever it was gone. Are you all right? He asked. It's nothing to upset us here, my heart. Wars never touch the two rivers. We are too far from everywhere for anyone to care. I'm not upset. Did Jain say anything else? Nothing you can believe. He sounded like a Coplin. He said the peddler told him these people use Aes Sedai in battle, but then he claimed they offer 1,000 gold marks to anyone who turns an Aes Sedai over to them, and they kill anybody who hides one. It makes no sense. Well, it's nothing to trouble us. It is all a long way from here. Aes Sedai. Egwene touched her head. The way back comes but once. Be steadfast. She noticed Rand had a hand to his own head. The headaches? She asked. He nodded, his eyes suddenly tight. That powder Nynaeve gave me doesn't seem to be working the last few days. She hesitated. These headaches of his worried her. They grew worse every time they came now. And worst of all was something she had not noticed at first, something she almost wished she never had noticed. When Rand's head hurt, strange things happened soon after. Lightning out of a clear sky smashing to bits that huge oak stump he had been working 2 days to root out where he and Tam were clearing new field. Storms that Nynaeve did not hear coming when she listened to the wind. Wildfires in the forest. And the deeper his pain grew, the worse what followed. No one else had connected these things to Rand, not even Nynaeve, and Egwene was grateful for that. She did not want to think about what it might mean. That is plain stupid foolish, she told herself. I must know if I am going to help him. Because she had a secret of her own, one that frightened her even as she tried to puzzle out what it meant. Nynaeve was teaching her the herbs, teaching Egwene to follow her as wisdom one day. Nynaeve's cures often worked in near miraculous fashion, wounds healed with barely a scar, sick folk brought back from the edge of the grave. But 3 times now Egwene had cured someone Nynaeve had given up for dead. 3 times she had sat to hold a hand through the last hour and seen the person get up from a deathbed. Nynaeve had questioned her closely on what she had done, what herbs she had used, in what blending. Thus far she had not found the courage to admit that she had done nothing. I must have done something. Once might be chance, but 3 times? I have to figure it out. I have to learn. That set off a buzz in her head, as though the words were echoing inside her skull. If I could do something for them, I can help my husband. Let me try, Rand, she said. And as she stood, through the open door, she saw a silver arch standing in front of the house, an arch filled with white light. The way back will come but once. Be steadfast. She took 2 steps toward the door before she could stop herself. She halted, looked back at Joya gurgling in her cradle, at Rand still pressing hand to his head and looking at her as if wondering where she was going. No, she said. No, this is what I want. This is what I want. Why can't I have this too? She did not understand her own words. Of course this was what she wanted, and she had it. What is it you want, Egwene? Rand asked. If it's anything I can get, you know I will. If I can't get it, I'll make it. The way back will come but once. Be steadfast. She took another step into the doorway. The silver arch beckoned her. Something waited on the other side. Something she wanted more than anything else in the world. Something she had to do. Egwene, I... There was a thump behind her. She looked over her shoulder to see Rand on his knees, bowed and head cradled in his hands. The pain had never hit him so hard. What will come after this? Ah, light, he panted. Light hurts. Light, it hurts worse than ever. Egwene? Be steadfast. It was waiting. Something she had to do. Had to. She took a step. It was hard. Harder than anything she had ever done in her life. Outside, toward the arch. Behind her, Joya was laughing. Egwene! Egwene, I can't! He cut off with a loud groan. Steadfast. She stiffened her back and kept walking, but she could not keep the tears from rolling down her cheeks. Rand's groans built to a scream, drowning Joya's laughter. From the corner of her eye, Egwene saw Tam coming, running as hard as he could. "He can't help," she thought, and tears became racking sobs. "There is nothing he can do, but I could. I could." She stepped into the light and was consumed. Trembling and sobbing, Egwene stepped out of the arch, the same by which she had entered, memory cascading back with Shiriam's face confronting her. Cold, clear water washed away her tears as Elida slowly emptied a silver chalice over her head. Her weeping went on. She did not think it would ever end. "You are washed clean," Elida pronounced, "of what sin you may have done and of those done against you. You are washed clean of what crime you may have committed and of those committed against you. You come to us washed clean and pure in heart and soul." "Light," Egwene thought as the water ran down her body. "Let it be so. Can water wash away what I did?" "Her name was Joya," she told Shiriam between sobs. "Joya, nothing can be worth what I just... what I..." "There is a price to become Aes Sedai," Shiriam replied, but the sympathy was back in her eyes, stronger than before. "There is always a price." "Was it real? Did I dream it?" Weeping swallowed what she wanted to say. "Did I leave him to die? Did I leave my baby?" Shiriam put an arm around her shoulders, began guiding her around the circle of arches. "Every woman I have ever watched come out of there has asked that question. The answer is no one knows. It has been speculated that perhaps some of those who do not come back chose to stay because they found a happier place and lived out their lives there." Her voice hardened. "If it is real, and they stayed from choice, then I hope the lives they live are far from happy. I have no sympathy for any who run from their responsibilities." The edge on her tone softened slightly. "Myself, I believe it is not real, but the danger is. Remember that." She stopped in front of the next glow-filled arch. "Are you ready?" Shifting her feet, Egwene nodded, and Shiriam took her arm away. "The second time is for what is. The way back will come but once. Be steadfast." Egwene trembled. "Whatever happens, it cannot be worse than the last. It cannot be." She stepped into the glow. She stared down at her dress, blue silk sewn with pearls, all dusty and torn. Her head came up and she took in the ruins of a great palace around her. The royal palace of Andor in Camelin. She knew that and wanted to scream. "The way back will come but once. Be steadfast." The world was not the way she wanted it, no way that she could think of without wanting to cry, but all her tears had been cried away long ago, and the world was as it was. Ruin was what she expected to see. Careless of making more rips in her dress, but as careful of sound as a mouse, she climbed one of the piles of rubble and peered into the curving streets of the inner city. As far as she could see, in every direction lay ruin and desolation, buildings that looked as if they had been torn apart by madmen, thick plumes of smoke rising from the fires still burning. There were people in the streets, bands of armed men prowling, searching, and Trollocs. The men shied away from the Trollocs, and the Trollocs snarled at them and laughed, harsh, guttural laughter. But they knew each other, worked together. A Murdral came striding down the street, its black cloak swaying gently with its steps, even when the wind gusted to drive dust and rubbish past it. Men and Trollocs alike cowered under its eyeless stare. "Hunt." Its voice sounded like something long dead crumbling. "Do not stand there shivering. Find him." Egwene slipped back down the pile of jumbled stones as silently as she could. "The way back will come but once. Be steadfast." She stopped, afraid the whisper had come from Shadowspawn. In some way, though, she was sure it had not. Glancing back over her shoulder, half fearful of seeing the Murdral standing where she had just been, she hurried onward and into the ruined palace, climbing over fallen timbers, squeezing between heavy blocks of collapsed masonry as she made her way. Once she stepped on a woman's arm, sticking out from under a mound of plaster and bricks that had been an interior wall and perhaps part of the floor above. She noticed the arm as little as she noticed the great serpent ring on one finger. She had trained herself not to see the dead buried in the refuse heap Trollocs and Dark Friends had made of Camelin. She could do nothing for the dead. Forcing her way through a narrow gap where part of the ceiling had fallen, she found herself in a room half buried under what had stood above it. Rand lay with a heavy beam pinning him across the waist, his legs hidden beneath the stone blocks that filled half the room. Dust and sweat coated his face. He opened his eyes when she came near him.
"You came back,"
he forced the words out in a hoarse rasp.
"I was afraid. No matter. You have to help me."
She sank wearily to the floor. "I could lift that beam easily with air, but as soon as it moves, everything else will come down on top of you, on top of both of us. I cannot manage all of it, Rand." His laugh was bitter and painful, and cut off almost as soon as it began. Fresh sweat glistened on his face, and he spoke with an effort.
"I could shift the beam myself. You know that. I could shift that and the stones above, all of them. But I have to let go of myself to do it, and I can't trust that. I cannot trust..."
He stopped, wheezing for breath.
"I do not understand," she said slowly.
"Let go of yourself? What can't you trust? The way back will come but once. Be steadfast." She rubbed her hands roughly over her ears.
"The madness, Egwene. I am actually holding it at bay."
His gasping laugh made her skin prickle.
"But it takes everything I have just to do that. If I let go, even a little, even for an instant, the madness will have me. I won't care what I do then. You have to help me."
"How, Rand? I've tried everything I know. Tell me how and I will do it." His hand flopped out, fell just short of a dagger lying in the dust, bare-bladed.
"The dagger," he whispered.
His hand made a painful journey back to his chest.
"Here, in the heart. Kill me."
She stared at him, at the dagger, as if they were both poisonous serpents.
"No, Rand, I will not. I cannot. How could you ask such a thing?"
Slowly his hand crept back toward the dagger. His fingers came short again. He strained, moaning, brushed it with a fingertip. Before he could try again, she kicked it away from him. He collapsed with a sob.
"Tell me why," she demanded. "Why would you ask me to murder you? I will heal you. I will do anything to get you out of there, but I cannot kill you. Why?" "They can turn me, Egwene."
His breathing was so tortured she wished she could weep.
"If they take me, the Myrdral, the Dreadlords, they can turn me to the shadow. If madness has me, I cannot fight them. I won't know what they are doing till it is too late. If there is even a spark of life left when they find me, they can still do it. Please, Egwene, for the love of the light, kill me."
I can't, Rand. Light, help me, I cannot."
"The way back will come but once. Be steadfast."
She looked over her shoulder, and a silver arch filled with white light took up most of the open space among the rubble.
"Egwene, help me.
Be steadfast."
She stood and took a step toward the arch. It was right there in front of her. One more step and...
"Please, Egwene, help me. I can't reach it. For the love of the light, Egwene, help me."
"I cannot kill you," she whispered. "I can't. Forgive me."
She stepped forward.
"Help me, Egwene!"
Light burned her to ash. Staggering, she stepped out of the arch, neither noticing her nakedness nor caring. A shudder ran through her, and she covered her mouth with both hands.
"I couldn't, Rand," she whispered. "I couldn't. Please forgive me. Light, help him. Please, light, help Rand."
Cold water poured over her head.
You are washed clean of false pride, Elida intoned. You are washed clean of false ambition. You come to us washed clean in heart and soul. As the Red Sister turned away,